Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. It has been a dizzying week or two with a number of issues swirling around Ukraine, Syria, Turkey, Brexit, and I feel like we could go on and on. And so today we're going to do a little bit of tour de horizon of the transatlantic relationship. And to join us, we have a fantastic guest. We have Audun Halvorsen, who is the Norwegian State Secretary to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And a little bit about him, he now holds this position, which is equivalent to Deputy Minister, and he has been there since 2017. Prior to this, he served as the Foreign Minister's political advisor from 2013 to 2017. And before his time in government, he was the political advisor on defense policy and foreign affairs for the Conservative Party Parliamentary Group of Norway.
And I think it's important to note that, number one, a great friend of the United States and a great friend of mine, and really appreciate that you come to see us. But, you know, his boss, Ina Sarita, the foreign minister, former defense minister of Norway, is also a great friend of the United States and mine and others as well. And I can't think of a better boss. And she was also one of the first to be on this podcast. She was in Washington, and we picked up our microphones and went to the embassy and had a great podcast. So you are here as part of a long line of famous Norwegians who appear on Brussels Sprouts. You know, just to kick things off, I have to say that I take a lot of personal joy in having a podcast with someone from Norway, because when I started in the policy part of the Pentagon, lo, these many years, I was the Norway desk officer. And this was as the Berlin Wall fell. I was deeply involved with Norway and all of the Norwegian issues, and I learned, frankly, a lot about Europe through the Norwegian lens. And so I still appreciate that very much. And one of the things that I began to learn through Norway was about the Arctic, the European Arctic, and the issues that Norway has in terms of its national security, but just the environment within which Norway lives, the people who fish those waters and those that drill for oil in those waters. It's so important to Norway, and I really learned about that. I remember briefing Dick Cheney when he was the Secretary of Defense, and he visited Norway, one of the first secretaries to visit, certainly after the Cold War. But I remember being on a plane, and we were talking about this, and they were learning about Norway for the first time, too. So it was a great visit, but a great piece of understanding about the Arctic from that Norwegian perspective. You know, I would like to hear from you how Norway looks on the Arctic. I think our listeners would like to know that. And then I have a personal comment about Russia and the Arctic, and I want to see what you think about that. But let's start off. Why don't you tell us a bit about how Norwegians look on the Arctic?
Well, first of all, thank you for those very kind words of introduction and welcome. And I have to say, Andrea and Jim, it's a great pleasure for me to be here. I am actually a regular listener to the podcast as well, so it's an extra pleasure. And as you described, the Norwegian-U.S. relationship is such a close one. The U.S. is by far our most important ally. It's a relationship that goes back through time on the people-to-people's level, culturally, historically, politically, and of course, a very, very strong relationship when it comes to security and defense, both through the NATO alliance, but also bilaterally. And it's a relationship and a friendship that is hugely important to Norway. So that is why maintaining the close dialogue with Washington is so important for us, and also why we visit regularly and try to maintain that dialogue. And of course, when it comes to your question on the Arctic and the high north, Jim, what we are seeing that this is, in general, this is still a region dominated by stability and predictability. And it's a key priority for Norwegian Arctic policy to keep it that way. We have five coastal Arctic states, the eight Arctic states in general, actually having built a framework for governance and cooperation over the last 2.5 decades, especially, through the Arctic Council, through the Euro-Arctic Barents Council, these regional frameworks, and also all the Arctic actors very clear in their adherence to international law, the law of the seas. So I think at the outset, I would like to sort of dispel this myth of the Arctic as this huge, unregulated, free-for-all area, which is, you know, bound to be the arena for some great power struggle. That is not the way Norway see it, and I would argue that it's not how it really is. That being said, we also need to recognize and address the military strategic dimensions of the region. And they are very real and sort of re-emerging after a 25-year hiatus. That is, you know, especially due to the fact that you have the Kola Peninsula as the main base of the Russian nuclear SSBN forces of the Northern Fleet. And this, of course, makes the, you know, in itself, it makes the region one of huge strategic importance. These are critically important assets to Russia that they need to protect, that they need to defend in any kind of crisis or global conflict. And that has huge implications, not only for Norway being a small neighbor to a big country, but for the region and also for Europe and the transatlantic community and for NATO, and potentially also for the US itself.
Yeah.
So it, you know, for us, it's finding the right balance between these two dimensions. On the one hand, the well-functioning cooperation, the dialogue on issues of mutual interest, environmental issues, search and rescue, scientific collaboration, which has been ongoing, especially under the aegis of the Arctic Council, while on the other hand, managing the strategic dimension. So that's a sort of the brief introduction.
Well, I just want to follow up real quick to see what you think about something I've been mulling over quite a bit since the past couple of years as I've been doing more and more Arctic things with other think tanks here in Washington. I've been worried about the militarization of the Arctic. It's something that no one wants to see. I think sometimes, whether it's in Washington or other places, that we are creating a crisis there or a military problem there that might not actually be present, that we might actually find ourselves causing something. Now, the Russians have put on paper command structure changes in terms of how they view, you know, the command and control of a military operation up there. We hear about the Russians opening up old former Soviet facilities there. In a lot of ways, doing things that any nation might have done should a maritime channel suddenly open up because of global warming, that we're not necessarily seeing something over and above what one might see. We're not seeing an aggressive Russia going up there with military capability and doing things that that we need to respond to militarily. I say that, and I need to caveat that if in fact that's the case, being an old Cold Warrior myself, I have no problems going up there to confront a military threat if we need to deter that. But I don't want us to create something that's 10 feet tall and back into a problem up in the Arctic militarily. That was not there, but now has kind of been created as we've misperceived one another. I say that, and I lay that in front of you to ask you what you think about that proposition.
No, I think it's a great question, and I think it strikes at the very core of this duality, which I mentioned initially. And of course, first of all, we have to recognize that Russia is by far the biggest Arctic actor and the biggest Arctic nation. They have, you know, very legitimate interests and ambitions for developing the Russian Arctic. And they have a strong tradition and a political, you know, clearly expressed political willingness to do so. This is a priority for them. So a lot of what we are seeing when it comes to development of infrastructure, when it comes to resource extraction, especially in the form of energy, when it comes to wanting regulation for what is going to happen in the potential transit in the Northeast Passage. These are legitimate and reasonable Russian policies. So I think we need to, on the one hand, as I said, sort of recognize that, while on the other hand, being very conscious of the implications, as I would say, especially on the military side, potentially for NATO. What we are seeing is, of course, that you've had a substantial increase in the Russian capabilities when it comes to I would say, especially their naval assets, also when it comes to technology. They are exercising more with much higher quality, much more complex, which we, you know, we need to be aware of that development. We need to follow it very closely. Right. We need to know what's going on.
Maritime domain awareness.
Yes, least to avoid the potential for misunderstandings, as you say, for escalation and misperceptions.
Yeah.
So, and I think NATO is doing a lot in that regard and has been doing so, driven not the least by, the initiatives from allies in the region, such as the US, Norway, UK, really prioritizing the reform of the command structure,
right.
The reestablishment of the Joint Force Headquarters in Norfolk for the North Atlantic specifically, the focus on the maritime domain of NATO, which is not really Arctic specific, but it's these are measures that have a very clear impact on NATO's understanding of the region and its role in the region. So I think we need to separate what is what, because there are obvious also strategic implications of some of these measures. And I would point especially to the submarines as a very sort of concrete new development with potentially huge implications for NATO. But that being said, a lot of what is going on is completely legitimate and understandable.
So I wanted to follow up on Jim's comment because I just left a meeting this morning where someone laid out a Kerch Strait-like scenario with the Russians. And they kind of made the argument that Russia's military posture exceeds what the risks to Russia should be, and that Russia was therefore poised to increase its assertiveness in the Arctic, perhaps through sinking a ship or seizing a ship, and that the United States and NATO wouldn't be prepared to respond. And so it kind of gets at this idea that there people are thinking along these lines. And to Jim's question, does that then lead the United States and NATO to over-respond to what's happening there? So I guess my question is this. One, what do you think of that type of scenario? Is that something that you worry about? And then the underlying question there is then what do you think Russia's goals in the Arctic currently are?
Hmm. Well, first of all, I think the scenario, given the current situation, might sound a bit far-fetched.
Alarmist, maybe.
What we are seeing, of course, which is a new development only this year, is that Russia has introduced new regulation for foreign military and state vessels wanting to sort of passage through the Northeast Passage, which is a recent development that we need to sort of analyze more fully as to the implications. But traditionally, Russia has been very respectful of the law of the seas. They have been one of the clear proponents and supporters of using this framework also in the Arctic. And it has been sort of in their interest to maintain that stability and that the respect of the actors for that framework. If you look at the Northeast Passage today, of course, traffic is picking up, but it's still rather limited. You haven't seen this huge boom that many imagined a couple of years back. It's increasing when it comes to energy exports, going both to the Asian market and to the European market, in the form of LNG mostly. But still, most of it is still sort of transit traffic between Russian destinations. There is still a lot of interest, I would say specifically from Asian actors, as to the commercial viability and potential in the Northeast Passage. And the Russians obviously have ambitions to develop it. But it's still some time off, is our assessment, just due to the sort of unpredictability of the other factors in play and how that influences the Northeast Passage as a potential major shipping route. The lack of search and rescue capabilities, the weather, These are very shallow waters, even after you move beyond sort of the Russian territorial waters. So even though the ice is melting, it's still no... it's not a very predictable route. I think that's a major issue for a lot of the shipping actors. The Russians obviously have a huge ambition in developing it. So, and that is, I think, part of what is driving what we are seeing now in the investment in infrastructure, and also the reopening of some of these old Soviet bases, which are now sort of dual-use military-civilian infrastructure, also to basically provide services for this passage to function as a viable shipping route.
One of the projects that we're kicking off here in the Transatlantic Security Program is a project looking at Russia-China relations. And as many people have recognized, the relations between Russia and China are growing. When you look across economic cooperation, trade and defense, or trade and military cooperation, the political ties between Putin and Xi, kind of all indicators suggest that ties are deepening. And in many key regions, their interests are aligned or at least overlapping. But one question I think that stands out is the extent to which that holds in the Arctic. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on how you portray the potential for greater cooperation between Russia and China, the extent to which you think their interests are aligned, or the extent to which you think there's some divergence there that could create a zone for potential conflict between them.
No, I think that is a key question, not the least for the Russians themselves. Yeah. And I think it presents them with a dilemma, because they obviously would like to see Chinese investments in the energy sector when it comes to infrastructure. But on the other hand, this is a very strategically sensitive area for them. And they have huge domestic ambitions to develop it, not least on energy and resource extraction. So sort of striking that balance, you know, inviting them in to invest, but while maintaining the necessary distance, I think that is a key question. And not only for Russia, I think that is part of what you are seeing in many of the other Arctic states as well. Because, our position is that we welcome engagement in the region when it is in accordance with international law, with respect for international law, and takes place within the existing governance structures, such as the Arctic Council. And so far, we are seeing that, for example, the Chinese are respecting that and working within the existing governance structure as an observer to the Arctic Council. So it needs to be balanced, but I don't think it's necessarily that the Russians will sort of let them in on all parts of what they are doing in the Arctic.
It's hard, I think, for a lot of people, including myself, to try to figure out what does it look like when we talk about China, when we talk about China being involved in the Arctic. We talk about China having interests, as you said, one of the Asian players or interested parties in terms of the Russian passage. What does that look like in terms of China? I mean, when you think of that, you think of Chinese ships using the passage, okay? And like any other countries, they're going to want to use that passage to save money and cut transit times. But I have a hard time thinking of it in terms of Chinese military ships going through, or Chinese military challenge to the Russians, or the Russians thinking that whether it's the U.S. or China or anyone else, that there's going to be a military fight in the Arctic over this channel, or the Chinese saying we would like to establish a military facility there. I mean, I guess I keep getting back to this idea of militarization of the Arctic and armies, militaries finding themselves fighting there, including NATO. I mean, people talk about a NATO role in the Arctic as if NATO ships are going to be sailing up the Norwegian coast into the Arctic to take on the Northern Fleet. I mean, I wonder, when we talk about that, what does it really look like in terms of just the Chinese and the Chinese in the passage? I mean, Andrea, that's a question for you too.
No, and I think it's a great question, and a question I understand is very high on the agenda here in Washington as well. And I would say understandably so. But you know, looking at the current situation, I would say that the Chinese footprint is still rather limited. They have an obvious interest. They have recently presented their Arctic strategy. They have a research presence several places. There's a lot of talk about infrastructure investments. But if you look at what has actually taken place, how a lot of these very public transactions have, they have not in fact taken place. Huge land grabs in Iceland, for example.
Yeah, Greenland.
Didn't
yeah,
happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And also in the Norwegian high north, there is a lot of interest. There is a lot of dialogue. But looking at what is actually happening on the ground, it's still rather limited. And I would say well regulated.
Yeah.
And given, of course, the growing awareness that is we are seeing across sort of the West transatlantic community, Europe, on how to deal with some of these potential challenges when it comes to investments in critical infrastructure, when it comes to the telecoms sector, when it comes to technology. It's, the awareness, as the awareness is growing, so is our resilience and our ability to resist, what should I say, penetration, which we don't want.
Yeah,
and you are seeing that. You are seeing, for example, the Danish government investing in airports and critical infrastructure in Greenland to another level than they were planning just some years back. And of course, we shouldn't sort of close off our societies and the possibilities for outside actors to invest in the high north. But we need to have the frameworks, the regulation, and the dialogue between allies to be able to sort of do the necessary risk assessments, and I think we are slowly moving there.
Yeah.
What a transition, just a tiny bit. So keep talking about Russia, but maybe talk a little bit more broadly. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about what the current state of Norway's relationship mm-hmm. is with Russia? Any mm-hmm. recent changes, changes in perception of maybe what's happening domestically inside mm-hmm. Russia in terms of Putin's hold on power? Mm. We've obviously seen a lot of protests as public approval ratings are quite low. Mm. So any kind of what does that picture look like from where you're sitting?
Mm. Well, of course, Russia is Norway's neighbor. So we have throughout history and even going back to sort of the depths of the Cold War, we have always tried to maintain a working relationship first with the Soviet Union, then with Russia. It has gone, what to say, up and down throughout history. But our approach has always been, a very clear commitment to the Western alliance, to NATO, strong bilateral ties to key allies, the US, of course, the UK, strong dialogue with the EU, never compromise on our key core interests and values. But using that, commitment or very clear position as a sort of point of departure for trying to engage Russia constructively where it is possible. And we are not doing that because we believe huge changes are possible overnight. We are not doing it because we have a sort of a naive belief that Putin will change his course and his policies. But we are doing it because it is necessary to sort of maintain the day-to-day cooperation and just the fact that we are neighbors. So we see that especially in the high north. We are working, on a day-to-day basis when it comes to border control, when it comes to Coast Guard cooperation, search and rescue at sea. These are important issues for the safety and security of the populations living there. But also on the political policy level, we have bilateral commissions, a formalized framework for dialogue and cooperation on key issues such as environmental protection, nuclear safety, fisheries management, hugely important both to maintain the livelihood of the population in the north and economically very prosperous. So these are, we have a working relationship, and there's also a political dialogue which has been maintained, even given the current tensions of the last five years. So only this week, Foreign Minister Eriksen Søreide will meet Sergei Lavrov in Kirkenes, which is to the very far northeast. It's a border town between Norway and Russia, where there is actually a commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Soviet army liberating eastern Finnmark, you know, which is a very important historical commemoration for Norway, for Russia, and not the least for the population in that part of Norway.
You know, it's interesting. That fight up there was very bloody. And it's, as you look at the annals of World War II and the battles that were fought, there's not a lot that's talked about in terms of that particular front up there. Mm. But it was, when you go up there and you read the memorial and you learn what happened, it was it's something worthy of commemoration. I'm glad that's happening. That was quite a bloody fight. Let me, if I can, let's leave the high north and go down to Brussels, which is, as you know, the center of Europe. I want to talk about NATO real quick. And being from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, you play a very important role in terms of the politics of NATO and what's happening there. And Ina Sarita, the foreign minister, was a wonderful defense minister. As I mentioned earlier, she was just a real leader in that. And I think, frankly, what Norway does in defense and the military side in terms of the professionalism and the cutting edge of your military is something that I think the Norwegian people should be very proud of. I'm not sure how aware they are of what the United States and other allies think in terms of the high regard Norway has held in terms of defense. I every time I go there, and I was there just a few years ago with the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, and we all came away so impressed with what we saw. And I hope the Norwegian people are very proud of what their military and their defense establishment does. But at NATO, as you've gone down for foreign ministers' meetings and other meetings there, and as you talk to the Norwegian SecGen, for who is, of course, a very famous Norwegian too, what are you picking up in terms of the mood in the hallways as you talk to your counterparts, as you go to the coffee shop, as everybody does, and exchange the latest on what's happening? You know, the alliance has been through some turbulence, and not just because of United States and other things too, but it's where, you know, there is just Europe and the transatlantic relationship changes, and things within Europe change too. So what are you picking up there? What's the mood like? What's the feeling like in the alliance, whether it's about the future or what's happening currently? What are you hearing?
Well, first of all, I would like to emphasize, I truly believe that there is a success story that can be told regarding NATO's development and adaptation to a new security policy situation over the last years. If you look at how the alliance has developed, you know, from Wales 2014, Warsaw 2016, then to Brussels, and the steps that are being taken, you know, the decisions that have been made, the steps that have been taken along the way, I think we are on a good course. You know, we have made a lot of necessary adjustments to how the alliance works. The command structure, the readiness initiative. So I think we've sort of built the framework for a relevant NATO for our times, which, you know, now needs to be implemented. And you've also seen, I would argue, a very clear positive trend when it comes to burden sharing, which is a key question. European allies should be doing more. They need to continue to do more. But the trend in general is positive. So I think it's, as part of the leaders' meeting in London in December, it is important to get that story out. We need to be clear on that message. The alliance has adapted, is adapting, it is relevant. And the community of allies and sort of the political community that NATO also is, in addition to being the world's strongest military alliance, you know, is still there, and it's still working. That being said, I think we should not, you know, underestimate that there are also tensions, forces creating potential divisions. One very current, ongoing discussion is, of course, allies' reaction to Turkish military operation in Syria and their unilateral action, which I think has been universally condemned, including by NATO allies. But Turkey remains a key ally, and we need to continue to engage. We need to continue to keep Turkey on board in NATO. And I think that is a vital point when it comes to the coherence and unity of the alliance. There are also developments, I would say, on the European side, where you are seeing necessary steps to strengthen the European pillar of NATO. And Norway's position on this is always very clear. These efforts need to be complementary to NATO efforts, not in competition. And we enter into cooperation with the EU on defense and security issue, CDSP, on that premise. That being said, I think there is a real potential for the EU to do more on the defense side. And I a lot of the initiatives that are ongoing, I think, are positive in that regard. You have the PESCO projects. You have the European Defence Fund now being discussed as a sort of permanent program with its own budget line in the EU joint budget. And these are, steps that should be, and mechanisms that should be leveraged to increase and strengthen European defence. But we should not have allies using them for the opposite.
Yeah.
But I also think there might be... perhaps a lack of in-depth understanding as to how they work.
Right, I think that's absolutely right.
Because there is, even though there might be some, let's say, industrial competition, there I don't really see it as as mechanisms that are being thought of as shutting out the U.S., for example.
Yeah.
So, but sort of gaining that common understanding of the purpose, the functioning of these initiatives, I think is important.
Yeah.
There are ongoing things, but also I would say EU-NATO cooperation going in the right direction, but needs to be accelerated.
Yeah, well, I think the meeting in December will certainly be an interesting one.
Yeah.
There's clearly a lot of landmines and things that could go wrong, but hopefully they won't. Well, we know you have a very busy schedule while you're here in Washington, D.C., I guess. In terms of final questions, is there anything that we didn't cover? Were there any kind of messages that you would want to be able to articulate to Americans or to listeners, I should say more specifically, that you weren't able to communicate over the course of this discussion, which has been far-reaching?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. And again, thank you so much for inviting me on the show. And thank you for what you're doing in your work for building the understanding of the importance of the transatlantic link and the relationship between the U.S. and Europe. I think it's critically important, especially in our time. So
tell your foreign minister we said hello.
And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.